Talk given Saturday, 6th April, 1974. We all know that the ultimate basis for all of us of religious truth is the realization of transcendence through the millennia. Those who have realized the transcendence, to put it in an even better form, those who have been the perfect media through whom transcendence realized itself, had an experience, went through an experiencing which is the root out of which all the religious teachings of the world have sprung, without exception. It is in this experiencing that the unity of religion lies. There is one unity which all living creatures experience, that is hunger, physically. And hunger can be satisfied in so many different ways. So too, there is this single root of religious truth, which is the experiencing by the individual of transcendence realizing itself through him. In the experiencing, he does not know at all that he is experiencing, or that he is going through an experience. Whatsoever you or I can know at the time of experiencing that I am going through such and such an experience is not the ultimate that can be realized through human beings. Because when I know that I'm going through an experience, I am separate. I am isolatively self-conscious as a subject looking at a separate object, the experience. And that is not the ultimate reality. Because reality must of necessity be one reality. The oneness is split by my isolative self-consciousness, which separates me from the experience, from the rest of the universe. So, whilst one can have exalted, sublime experiences, in the Supreme Communion, there is no knowing by the individual at all. The whole process of knowing, the very meaning of knowing, implies a separation between the knower and the known. Knowing means being in a state where analysis interferes with total integration. But in this experiencing, there is the state of total integration without the interference of any analytical process. And therefore, in that experiencing, there is no knowing. Therefore, that ultimate truth, that ultimate reality can never be handed over in its total reality to anybody. You can't speak of it. One can say that there is such a thing as that experiencing, which one goes through, at the time at which one goes through, one doesn't know. Afterwards, the impress of that experiencing is so powerful that if the mind is a sufficiently trained mind, the impress, the memory of the impress, can get translated in terms of thought and speech, as we understand thought and speech. And when it gets translated as thought and speech, in the way each one of us understands thought and speech, it will necessarily bear the impress of all the conditioning of our cultural heritage, first and foremost, as well as our psychophysical heritage, so that it will be a conditioned picture of reality. If 20 people, let us say 20 great artists, made a portrait of any one of us, those 20 portraits would be different. Because those portraits will bear the stamp of the artist's own conditioning. So now, this memory process sets to work and makes a picture of it. And the pictures could be very widely different, so widely different that it seems as if some of the religions of the world are entirely opposed to each other. We must bear this very carefully in mind. Because if we don't, we'll fall into all sorts of errors and squander our energies in what we call, quite sincerely but mistakenly, the search for truth, for reality. Or we may wishfully try to patch the whole thing, to patch all the different religious presentations together, make a patchwork quilt of it, and say, ah, there you are, there is the unity of religion, of the religions of the world. That isn't the unity at all. It's a patchwork quilt made in order to please me, to satisfy my wishful intellectual demand, because I'm unable to face the fact that as presented, they are all considerably different from each other, and in certain cases, oppositely different from each other, irreconcilably different from each other. Now this should awaken us to the fundamental necessity to approach truth in the religious context, in the religious sense, with a totally open mind. We do not have an open mind. Our minds are very much conditioned, so heavily conditioned, that we are unable to fling open all the doors and the windows. In fact, to be without any surrounding walls, mental walls. If we are capable of being totally free of those surrounding mental walls, what we commonly call, and not quite unjustifiably call, our mind would be identical with universal mind, which is transcendent mind, in which case there is no confusion, there is no difficulty at all. Now, this open-mindedness, we cannot seek open-mindedness positively. Open-mindedness, total open-mindedness, is our natural characteristic and birthright, but it is withheld from us by us ourselves and by all the conditioning influences, particularly people around us. We raise up these walls, the cultural heritage, as we call it. The cultural heritage is of immense value, make no mistake about that. But it also is the great conditioner. From infancy, we are brought up to believe, to think. Our whole thinking process is conditioned from our childhood, to feel, to act, and so forth. Everything is conditioned. Now, when we realize that fact, when we really see into it, we will also see another very important point in connection with it. When we are born in the innocent state, the word innocent meaning unknowing, totally unknowing, ignorant state. Supposing we were left alone at the moment of our birth on this planet, no other human beings. And let us assume that somehow we will survive and grow up. Rather a difficult job, but let us suppose that we do survive and grow up. We will remain ignorant, desperately ignorant, in the human sense. And what is more, especially because language and the speech faculty undergoes no development till we are about 11 or 12, then never after that is it possible for us to learn anything, supposing we came into touch with human beings. That is the end for us. Now, this cultural heritage, which we get from those surrounding us, which conditions us, as we have just seen, is the very thing, this conditioning is the very thing that produces the challenging element that can draw out of us, out of our own inward response, can draw out of us the way to freedom from the conditioning. And in the process of the way to freedom from the conditioning, ignorance gets dispelled, consciousness, in other words, and this power of perception and understanding grows and grows because of this challenge and our answer to it. And when that happens, this latent sensibility which is in us, what I call this receptive, responsive sensitivity, which is mind in the fullest sense, grows, comes to flower, and therefore the possibilities of enlightenment, the possibility of that complete purification, of that that state of utter unresistingness to the inflow and outflow of transcendence, which means our religious fulfillment, can take place. One meaning, if you like, of eating the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden. It has to be eaten. We have to go through the conditioning, the limitation, in order that that challenge may exist. And then, as the Lord said, by the sweat of thy brow shalt thou earn thy bread, the spiritual bread. There is no escape from this. And every one of us, willy-nilly, will inevitably experience the fall, will be in the state of the fall. But there are only few, extremely few, out of the nowadays thousands of millions, who will make the right effort to stand up again on their own two feet. Not wallowing on the ground, fallen in an inglorious huddle together. It is a lone task, but not a lonely task. Mere loneliness is self-pitying, gets you nowhere. But it is the task of the alone. And it has to be the task of the alone, because this aloneness is one of the marvelous mysteries of our existence. It is a one totality, a one reality, a universe, as we call it, which nevertheless consists of innumerable, countless, limited particulars, which are finite and mortal, as contrasted with the obvious immortality of the totality. This is the marvel of it, that the one is the many, and the many are the one, not by mere addition, but by perfect integration, which is quite a different thing. It implies that the particular limited individual grows into the totality, just as the totality grows into the individual. And this process goes on simultaneously. The point moving out into the boundless sphere, and the boundless sphere enclosing itself into the point. this vibration, so to say, this dual vibration is taking place simultaneously all the time. It is for us to wake up to it. But if we let ourselves remain enclosed in our discriminative consciousness, vijnana, the analytical aspect of us will perpetually separate us, the individual, from fulfillment, from the transcendent real. It is a case of letting ourselves emerge into that state of awareness being, which is the state of God, Brahman, Ahura Mazda, say, use what word you like, of the one total reality. Now, the different religions have in fact presented in different ways just this sort of thing. And it is both instructive and helpful for each one of us in his or her religious growth and fulfillment to see how this fundamental reality is expressed in the different ways in different religions. We must beware of merely trying to interpret what one religion has presented conventionally and orthodoxly in terms of another religion. It will be very difficult to escape this verbally. It always is. We can't help it. But if we are aware through and through in our minds that there is this danger, we can, shall I say, pedal our bicycle safely through all the pitfalls, or shall I say, away from the pitfalls. Now, I've said all this because those of us present here who are specifically interested in Vedanta or in Buddhism or in the teachings of Jesus or the Kabbalah or whatever it may be, all of us have our special leaning, so to say, our special bias. Once we see that we have a special bias, we recognize the fact that that is the style which suits us, which perhaps distinguishes us. But just as a great artist has his own unique style, but if he's a truly great artist, he recognizes the unique styles of other great artists and sees the true relationships between them all. So too, although we may have our own specific style, whether it be Vedantist or Buddhist or whatever it may be, or Christian, whichever it may be, we recognize that the styles of all the others are also the styles of supreme realization. This prevents any conflict. This it is which makes for the harmony of utterly different, uniquely beautiful particulars, the different religions. And it is in that way, by our seeing this for ourselves, that we can release a force for inward unity, starting from the deeps of the psyche and extending right into the supreme spiritual nature of any individual in other people. Then we don't have to form societies for the unification of religions, etc., etc., or have the usual dialogues between Jews and Christians and donkeys and asses and God knows what not. All that becomes unnecessary. After all, a puppy can only yelp always, or yap, I should say, and a lion cub will always yelp. Is that the right thing? Right word? Yes. Lion cubs yelp, don't they? And puppies yap. So you see, that won't change. But if the puppy and the lion cub have a true flash of Satori, then they will recognize Buddha nature there. Moo. As they say in Zen. And quite rightly. Now, in our own day and age, the two major religions of India, Hinduism, and I mean specially the Rig Veda, the Upanishads, and the Gita, and Buddhism, are having a very great influence upon the rest of the world. What sort of influence is it? Is it an influence which emanates from a mind that is free of confusion? Is it an influence which clarifies the minds and purifies the hearts of people in other parts of the world so that there can be true harmony which emerges naturally as second nature from within each and every individual? Or is it an influence which merely ties a person born in another culture and faith, ties him up in knots and transfers him from Holloway to Pentonville? This is the point. If I have dirty clothes on of one sort, it's no good exchanging them for dirty clothes of another sort. That doesn't make me clean. Anyway, as far as my clothes are concerned. This influence has to be an influence of truth, of purity, of clarity, of peace and harmony from within the individual. The individual who lives constantly mindfully. Now, how can such an influence be generated? Not by desiring it, not by wishing it, not by this process of sankalpa, as we say in India, this planning and scheming that, we shall carry out such and such a campaign for the purification of the world. make the world good. It's totally impossible, foredoomed to failure. I can't even make myself good. I can only be sensible enough to see, truly to see, that which is not good. That which is not good. And see it not in terms of I am not good or you are not good, but this is not good, not true, not pure. And in that process of seeing that, the effect is on me, myself. Then, when this psychophysical being undergoes such change, such inward purification, then this omnipotent but never compelling and this omnipresent power, which is reality, which is God, which is the eternal, functions freely through me. And that influence invariably, without my being able to stop it, it invariably affects the environment and does what is needful. Look how beautiful nature is, how generous, how merciful. This is the mercy of God, if you like. The sun shines, and by its shining, all wonderful things happen by themselves, because the sun shines. The sun doesn't say, I shall shine thus and thus and produce such and such results. Here these poor earthworms, these earth creatures on the earth called men, have made such a mess of things that they have polluted the world's atmosphere. They are polluting the whole surface of the earth and the seas and so forth, killing off life and destroying the beauty. Now, I will shine in such and such a way as to get rid of all that pollution. No, the sun doesn't do anything of the sort. It just shines. And it'll keep on shining long after we are not even a memory of darkness on the face of the globe. But this is the way of the eternal. This is the way of God. This is the way of truth, of beauty, of the flowering of religiousness within ourselves. Now, we are a week away from Easter. From Easter week. You recall our considerations last December and January. The meaning and significance of Christmas as a holiday, a holy day. Why is it called holy? The traditional day of birth of Christ by the Christian world associated with the person of Jesus, Jesus Christ's birthday. We considered all that. And you remember we considered the meaning of his name, Yahshua. It's Yahweh, the absolute, the supreme, the incomprehensible deity, enshrined, enfleshed on this earth. That's the meaning of the name Yahshua, Joshua, Jesus. All those names are the same thing. And in the January meeting, You remember we considered especially that sentence of his, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And we tried to consider the deep meanings of each of those important words. Me. Who is the me? Just Jesus, a Hebrew born of his father and mother? No. The Christ consciousness and what it implies, how it is related to the Kabbalistic Tifereth, that Sephira, which symbolically is associated with the heart, the physical heart, the mediator between the right shoulder and the left shoulder. The right shoulder, which stands for Hesed, mercy, the utter mercifulness of the Lord's loving kindness, which is also in us, and the left shoulder, which stands for Geburah, stern judgment and punishment, which is also within us. Two conflicting and apparently irreconcilable powers, but they are mediated through the Christ consciousness, the Son of the Blessed. Tifereth is the Son of the Blessed, the Most High, the Transcendent, represented at the top of the head. And Tifereth stands for compassion, for beauty, for justice, for the love that has transcended all the limitations and binding factors of earthly love. It is the center where the transcendent can touch his own child, man, made in the image of the transcendent. See, the deep truths are so wonderful, they are so beautiful, that if one awakes to them in one's inner consciousness, and not merely with the top layer of the brain cells, with merely the intellect, but if one wakes up to them in one's inner consciousness, a transformation of one's own being takes place. And from that being, from your being, goes outwards the shining of the sun of liberation and of enlightenment. This is true. It's very hard to grasp it, to understand it, because immediately in our minds rise up all the problems. But how do you apply this in such and such a situation in everyday life when this happens, that happens? Yes. This is the great problem everyone faces, everyone has to face. I can only say in the words of the Buddha, do what you think fit. And what you think fit has to be a thinking which is the result of seeing the truth. Otherwise, you merely think in terms of your conditioning and your own petty little miserable desires and whims and appetites and ambitions and passions and fears. So now, this is the me to which one goes. And you remember at that January meeting, we saw that the culmination of the life of the sinless one, the Son of Man who had become identical with the Son of God, the culmination of that life was the crucifixion, ascension, and resurrection. I put them in different order, note carefully. Now, Easter is the time of the year associated with this dramatic, this cathartically dramatic, soul-harrowing event, crucifixion, and then the final freedom through ascension and resurrection. And it is always said resurrection of the body, orthodoxly, conventionally. Very interesting. Let us look a little bit into this crucifixion. One may realize the state wherein Tifereth, the heart center, Anahata of the yogi, has come to full fruition. That lotus has bloomed. There is the perfect man, the Siddha, the accomplished yogi in Eastern terms. But is that all? There is that which transcends all that. And it is this transcendent part which is that marvelous substratum, that eternal root of religiousness in us and of all the great religious teachings of the world. And this realization is not the realization of the Son of Man. It is the realization of transcendence itself through the Son of Man. But the Son of Man has to make the bridge, has to go through the abyss. And in going through that abyss, the bridge, the invisible, shapeless, formless, non-substantial, but the absolute bridge is built within the Son of Man himself. And this is the complete relinquishment of all self-consciousness. Whilst living in the body which is alive, this is the difficulty. Some of you at least have looked deeply into the Buddhist and Hindu presentations, which are the most explicit and the most complete, perhaps, of the scriptural revelations where this matter is concerned. Have you ever tried? Have you ever experienced yourself the relinquishment of the conditioned state? And what it brings with it. Some of you may recollect several months back, maybe a year or more back, we started one of our meetings with a short meditation of trying to be completely still and quiet. And some of you may remember, if any of you have got that particular tape, play it over again. You may remember one or two other points mentioned, namely that in that stillness, everything that is in the sphere of the manifestation of a psychophysical organism comes to its ending. The feelings come to their ending. The thoughts come to their ending. All the patterns of mind which are our deepest convictions, beliefs, and so forth they all come to their ending. Now, this is the moment of fear. This moment of fear is mentioned in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the first chapter, the fourth section, the second and third verses, I think. This moment of fear. Because this living organism is here, it won't let go because it fears extinction, annihilation. It must have something to hold on to. The mind confined within this organism, transcendent mind confined within this organism, is afraid to step out into the infinite. And that is the one and only step necessary. It is afraid to step out into the infinite. So it clings there. Now, he who has really learned and understood, in other words, as Krishnamurti would very rightly say, disciplined himself. To discipline means to learn, nothing else. Not to conform or constrict, but to grow in understanding. This is learning. He who has learned and disciplined himself has now a heart of love come to its maturity. He has a mind of wisdom, not knowledge, of wisdom, which is enlightenment itself. And if he has the two in balance, in harmony, then he is in the state which is fearless. The state which is symbolized by the word Atma in the Vedantist teachings. The dear philosophers and scholars have made a glorious muddle of the words Atma and Brahman. Forget them. They have tried to put it into logical, intellectual form. You can put all that into, on a cold night, you can put it into the right place, the great. But this state of being is the meaning of that word Atma. And here there is no fear. Way back in the Atharva Veda, describing the yogi who has realized, they talk of him as courageous, firm, wanting nothing, fearless. He who has known the Atma. In that fearless state, you can let go. Totally let go. And when you totally let go, that discriminative consciousness is transformed into transcendent awareness. Now, this letting go is the crossing of the abyss. In the letting go, momentarily at least, if not for a longer spell in terms of time, there is a state of complete death in our sense, our worldly sense of the word death, in the sense of annihilation. There is a complete blank. If you can remember this point and begin to understand it, then you read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo, the first aspect of the Bardo, and you will begin to see the profundity of that Tibetan Book of the Dead. Until then, you'll get all muddled up with its nice little 49 days and this, that, and the other. But this is it, which happens in consciousness. Now, this giving up is the crucifixion. We are made in the form of a cross, almost physically we are made in the form of a cross, and when we start, if you like to use the yin yang symbolism also, but represented as straight lines, it's a straight line like that. And a straight line, one straight line is vertical, the other is horizontal. They are of equal lengths and they form a square. That's the beginning of the cross. The descent into matter, the state of total forgetfulness of eternal reality, the absence of smriti, right remembrance. Plato talks of right remembrance, following what Pythagoras and the great mysteries taught, and so forth. Right remembrance. It is that descent into matter. Now, spirit is dead, so to say, immured in matter. It awakens to knowledge of itself. This is the cross of matter. I myself am that cross. But when I grow in understanding through love and wisdom in harmony, then that cross changes this wise. The horizontal line comes up. Whereas the horizontal line was in that state, which just formed the square, I call it the square cross, just for convenience we'll call it a square cross. You see, in that square cross, all that I do is to oscillate between the duals on the horizontal line, the extremes of the horizontal line, the pendulum going this way and that way, and so forth. That's all I do. You see? Then, when through understanding and love and wisdom this happens and this line goes up, instead of oscillating on the horizontal line, I become the Christian cross from the cross of matter, with the arrow pointing upwards now to the zenith. Just as in yoga the roots of that great Aswattha tree point upwards to the infinite and not into the earth, which holds in bondage. That is the meaning of the Christian cross, if you like. And after that ascent is made, and the Son of Man has realized that he is the Son of God, there comes that final stage when cross and everything disappears. Because in the act of crucifixion, I'm talking metaphorically now, symbolically, in the act of crucifixion, all limitation, all particularity, all finitude, all mortality has completely gone. But it has completely gone in a person who is still living in precisely the state of particularity, limitation, mortality in the body. This is the dread abyss which has to be traversed. And it's painful. And the Christians chose this symbolism for Jesus because crucifixion is one of the most painful, one of the most fearful things to go through. You remember Gethsemane. He who was so utterly confident of his Father God, who so utterly trusted, was afraid at the last moment. There was sweat upon his brow with the agony of it, because he knew what was coming. So it was no small thing. No one could accuse Jesus of running away. No one could accuse Jesus of being inimical to anybody. He quietly took back the ear which had been chopped off by the sword on one of the men who came to arrest him and restored him to his hearing. Very significant symbolically, restored him to his hearing, hearing the voice of truth. That was the type Jesus was, and yet he went through this agony. And then those last words on the cross, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. This is practically the climax. I say practically, you'll see in a moment why. This is practically the climax of this most extraordinarily dramatic event. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? What is the meaning of the word Eloi? It is translated as my God. And of course, all the world says, oh, God, the being upstairs, or whatever it is. Now look, Jesus was a master Kabbalist. The Kabbalah and the Jewish tradition presents the soul of man in three grades, three main grades. You know how in chapter 2 of Genesis, and the Lord God took the dust of the ground and made Adam and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and Adam became a living soul. And the word for living soul is nephesh. And nephesh stands for the vital principle in man. The vital principle, that is, and nephesh is considered the lowest of the three grades. It belongs to the psychophysical organism, which is still at the animal level. The next grade is ruah. In Zarathustrianism, we have the term urvan or ravan. Pahlavi term is ravan, Persian term. You see? Now, what is this ruah? Literally, it means spirit. At least, great Jewish scholars have translated it as spirit, literally. Its meaning, and they also say that it is the intellectual faculty, the middle of the three grades of the soul. Now, intellectual, not in our modern sense of the word, when those who produced the Zohar, for instance, it was produced through a succession of centuries, and finally, as Professor Scholem thinks, written down by Moses de Leon in the 13th century. An extraordinary century, the 13th century, in the history of Western Europe. In the Zohar, this ruah means the intellectual faculty, the word intellectual having a meaning akin to the meaning which was given by Aristotle. This profoundly discriminative perceptive power, not mere discriminative consciousness, vijnana, which includes such a lot, but this distinguishing power between the real, that is to say, in terms of the transcendent, the changeless, the immutable, and the ephemeral, the mortal. It is this intellectus which the medievals and those before them used. It is this which is the second grade. Now this you and I can bring to fulfillment here in our lifetime. Then there's the third aspect, the highest aspect, neshama, as it is called. And neshama is of Yahweh himself. Yahweh, the absolute all, the transcendent reality. The transcendent, as I've often said before, sits within us, within the mind. It is the untouched part of the mind, unsullied by all evil. It is the supreme omnipotence within us, moving us towards fulfillment and fruition without compulsion. But where our description is concerned, its supreme nature is moral rather than intellectual. It's ethical. That which brings to fruition is ethically right, good, perfect, isn't it? It cannot be otherwise. Therefore, it is the moral consciousness in a transcendent sense, not merely in the relative discriminative sense, ambivalently, good, bad. Because that is the state of conflict, this ambivalent state. This goes right beyond this ambivalence. It knows for an absolute certainty, precisely, this is the good. The absolute good. This is represented in the Rig Veda by the god Varuna. He is the moral governor of the universe, as they say. And he's called the son of Ritta. The other Rigvedic gods are also designated that way. The son of eternal order, of righteousness, and so forth. So this neshama is the third and the supreme aspect. When one has learned, purified, come to fulfillment, nefesh and ruah, the vital principle, this intellectual faculty, are completely empty of all obstruction. They are completely purified. They are a unity with neshama. This unity, this unified, divinized mind, the ekagrata, is the meaning of Elohi, transcendent Yahweh incarnate in Jesus. Momentarily, there is that complete blank in the crossing of the abyss. This moment is like an eternity of what seems annihilation. Hence the agonized cry, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" But in actual fact, there is no forsaking. There is perfect fulfillment. And in St. John's Gospel, we have the triumphant affirmation at the end. It is finished. That is, perfected, accomplished. This is liberation, moksha, nirvana. The Son of God has fulfilled the divine mission.